be against the law to look this damn good. Cause baby, I feel real good, and I wish I would. Watch out.
Welcome back after a minor technical fault where our broadcast wasn't going live. We're now back. So starting again, welcome to today's Agency Phonics podcast, episode 72. And very pleased to have Paul McEntee, founder of Here Be Dragons, with us. And we're just going to talk about his agency journey, his long career in the PR creative comms world. More in-depth chat about the evolution of earned media, some wider trends in the market and the future for agencies and brands. So, but before we get started, a huge thank you to Sante Group for their support of the community. Without their help, we couldn't do half of what we do. If your agency is thinking about your people and any health or wellbeing cover, lifestyle benefit choices, then speak to them first at either NugentSante.com or message David Booth in the community. And thank you to the team at Cactus Behind the Scenes for helping produce this lovely episode. Right, over to you, Paul. So it'd be lovely to hear about your agency journey from, you know, the big agency days through to, you know, the reason why you decided to found Here Be Dragons. So, yeah, tell us about your 20 plus year experience in the industry. From day one.
Thank you, mate. Thank you. Great. It's good to be on here. Thank you for having me. And big up to the wider Agenomics Cactus crew for everything you guys do to support agencies. Really appreciate it and love being part of your community. It's a nice one for that. It's great to be on the show. 20 years, been a journey. A lot has changed in that period of time in my environment, and I think, yeah, I mean, every founder or business owner listening to this would have had a sort of trigger moment where they wanted to start their own gig and go out on their own. I certainly did, but I think you can only get to this point by someone teaching you the ropes, because you don't just graduate and then start an agency. Some people do, I guess, but I didn't.
What attracted you to the agency world in the first place? Why were you kind of drawn into it and stuck around?
Well, look, there's certain things that going into a big networked agency or a big corporation, whatever the discipline, that attract you as a 20-something-year-old, right? Your peer group, getting to work on some sexy brands, working up in London. It was very exciting back then. Obviously, no one worked from home. It was frowned upon. You were in the big city and the hustle and bustle of going in every morning. That was enticing, right? It was like, you feel like you've arrived in the world, and that was cool. And, you know, the social stuff that happens at that age around big agencies was great. You go on press trips, you're working on launches. That was all very attractive. And, you know, my sort of employers, Mark Bukowski is a great publicist and still runs a great agency called Bukowski PR. And then my second employer, Edelman, the world's biggest PR agency, a Chicago firm that has 70 offices globally. That was they taught me great things. Worked on amazing clients at Xbox and Heineken and Car Front Warehouse and the London Olympics. And you do that for a period of time, and some people love it and become lifers right there, because there's the room to grow. And some people take a bit of it and move on, and other people take a bit of it and say, you know what, I can do this differently myself and maybe have a better work-life balance or a better approach to my work or a better creative outlook in how I deliver my campaign. So mine was a little bit of all of that. I think having done sort of nearly 15 years in those agencies, I wanted something different, definitely. When you see a big agency, how much they bill you out for versus what you get paid, you soon put two and two together and you go, you know what, I could do this myself. And it's a nice money doing.
Was it a blank sheet of paper as well, just saying, I want to start something that's my own, using the kind of best of ideas and the people I want to hire?
Yeah, I mean, look, the agency happened by accident. I was lucky enough that a client decided to come with me. which was very great, very good. So basically you get to sort of have a founding client, you know, you can pay the mortgage bills. It's actually, as soon as I handed him, I noticed the big agency, my wife told me she was pregnant with our first child. I was like, you're kidding, I've just handed him my notice. So it's like that sort of sink or swim moment. But that sort of gives you the impetus to go forth. And yeah, I was lucky that I had a founding client, and from there managed to grow that client, and then decided I needed a member of staff. So I got my first member of staff. He started to work experience. You actually know her, it was Sabrina. Big shout out to Sabrina. Yeah, it kind of grew by accident then. It sort of organically grew. And I think having had that first client, we landed upon a stunt brief for GIFGAF, the mobile telecoms network. And it was they were releasing an advert, and they wanted a PR agency to sort of amplify the ad, which is what you sort of did back then, I guess, in PR. In this ad, GIFGAF was all about not having contracts, and their whole sort of strapline was, we don't tie you down to contracts. They had all these flying people in the ad. And we pitched this idea, which was crazy. We had no idea if we could do it or not, but we pitched in this idea that we'd fly people across London, right, to amplify their ad, to mirror what happens on TV. And they bought it. They were like, yeah, we love this. So we had to figure out how to do it. We're like, crap. that's me remembering not to swear on this podcast. So we went away and we designed these drones, these human-shaped flying machines that were shaped like humans, the silhouette of a human, and three of them. And we sort of managed to lock down areas of London in parks and stuff that were right in front of big monuments like Big Ben and the London Eye and Canary Wharf and all those things, and fly these things with, you know, across the sort of skyline with a telescopic lens, you know, further away, capturing the key shot that you release to the newspapers and the video and stuff like that. And you couldn't do that stuff now because, you know, flying things with near buildings in London now with everything going on is just it's just not going to happen because of security risks. And yeah, it was great. It was like, you know, that was our first big client. We then sort of, having done a stunt for them, we managed to sort of worm our way into that business to become their sort of in-house agency. And at this point, we were still two people. So it was great for us. You know, we'd anchored a massive client with the ability to grow. We sort of spread our wings across that business, making that a retained account and doing everything from press office to their influencer stuff through to the experiential. And that was a relationship we sort of held for sort of 6-7 years. So we really grew them. You know, they started as a sort of a small sort of upstart with about, 300,000 members initially. And we sort of grew with them to become £500 million business. And that you just can't buy that sort of, you know, allegiance from a client over a long period of time anymore. It's very rare to have those long-standing relationships. Normally the tenure is about sort of 2 to 3 years.
What's the shape of the business now today, and what's your kind of proposition? Because you kind of rebranded a few years ago, taking away your name above the door.
When we started out, we wanted to come up with a name for the business and couldn't think of anything in time before we sort of, you know, registered at a company's house. So just put Mac and T, which is my surname, but with a ampersand in the middle instead of the middle bit of my name. We survived with that for sort of 4 or 5 years. But we decided in COVID to do a rebrand and switch to Here Be Dragons because we saw how much change there was in the world. And we thought we'd update our agency offering in order to sort of create the agency of the future, as we saw it, which could navigate the change in the world. So Here Be Dragons is actually an old cartology term that comes from the medieval period where it used to appear as Latin as Hicks and Draconis, which basically was a medieval translation to that, was that they used to put it on old maps when they hadn't charted the world properly. They didn't know what was at the furthest extremities of the world, so no one had been there, no one could come back. As if you imagine sort of sailors went off to sea and their boat capsized because of a storm and they never returned to shore. And so people thought they'd be eaten by dragons, right? That's what they thought. So they put Hicks and Draconis on the bits of the maps that they thought were dangerous and a picture of a serpent or a dragon. And we stumbled across this and we were like, wow, this is amazing. We're going to use that as our new ANCHI name. We couldn't believe that no one had copyrighted it in the UK in our vertical. So we did that and created this sort of, I guess, modern ANCHI, which is a bit more creative comms, but sort of built for understanding the change in the world. So what we say to clients is that Here Be Dragon sort of helps them navigate the world. So we understand which way the wind is blowing, the headwinds and the tailwinds. And we sort of hold the client's hand as we help them navigate the world. Because it became clear to us in COVID, I don't know if you noticed, Mark, but in COVID, all brands were panicking, right? And then Black Lives Matter happened and no one knew how to behave or how to respond to the massive societal upheaval that was happening around them. You know, CEOs of companies were putting out messages saying they support this and they stand for this. And there was all those tiles on Instagram and Black Lives Matter saying, we stand with you. And no one's really doing it correctly because they weren't backing up their sort of statements with real action. And it became very clear to us that with that huge sort of 2-year period of change, brands were really bad at navigating change. They didn't understand how to evolve, just like you and I evolve as people, right? We change and we mutate and we develop. And no brand should stand still either, right? Brands need to run with the times and be increasingly relevant to their consumer as things happen in society, which matter to their audience. And we noticed that so many brands were just getting it wrong in that period of time. So we sort of set up as, we're the ANCHI that helps you navigate the world. And Here Be Dragons was born. We're 15 people in Shoreditch. And we've got a dragon as our sort of icon and emblem. And that represents, I guess, the sort of work we do. We like to do sort of brave, creative work that, you know, really makes a difference in the world and can create really good impact for brands when we do all the crazy things we do in PR.
Yeah, great. Thank you. And I guess over the last 5-6 years, I mean, what have been the kind of key challenges? Have you thought about throwing in the towel and going back into big corporate, or what's made kind of building an agency, and often it's different stages of growth. Sometimes it's challenges around staff. Sometimes it's about clients. If you just had a kind of linear kind of journey of success.
No, I mean, I'd love to say I had, right? And, you know, we all have that imposter syndrome, right? Every founder probably does. And, you know, one day it's going great. The other day it's not going great. And you're sort of reassessing things. But that's all part of the journey. I think we all learned loads in COVID, didn't we? I certainly did. And it's sort of always fascinating to see how different businesses coped with COVID and how they came out of it. It was a real opportunity there for some people. For others, the opportunity was massively veiled in threat, which it sort of was for us. Sort of call that moment where we all got that government advice where we had to sort of, you know, work from home. Like, oh, this will blow over, just a couple of weeks. But then I called it sort of Black Wednesday. Sort of got 3 phone calls from clients, which ended up being sort of 45% of our revenue base at that point, and they just went just gone in a flash. So it's pretty scary, but you know, you roll with the punches, and luckily we didn't have to sack anyone, which is good, and you sort of build back better. But it's still been a roller coaster, because once you sort of came out of COVID, you sort of see the sort of light at the end of the tunnel. You're like, great, we're going to bounce back and all the clients are going to come back and hospitality's opened up again and travel's opened up again and all those sort of client leads from those sectors come back. And then obviously you have what's happened in Ukraine and the energy crisis, and now it's cost of living. So it's been for agencies of our size, I assume, across many verticals, you know, we've been buffeted hard by the winds for sure, right? Larger agencies probably slightly more resilient, but then sometimes they're the ones that are a bit more brutal in making cuts and being a bit more ruthless with how they reduce their headcount and their exposure. At our stage, you're still sort of like a sort of small and grown family, and you believe in it. So making, as much as you try and be a sort of business leader and make the right commercial decision for the business, we're still building something. And you've got to believe that. You know, I think that this year, it's still obviously, it's still a bit of ebb and flow as far as the economy, But I think H2 is going to be really strong. And I think 2024 is hopefully an opportunity to really look forward to for many businesses, because the cost of living will have subsided. Hopefully the energy crisis will have too. So I think you've got to be buoyant, but it's always a roller coaster. You've really got to have a sort of tunnel vision and a sort of belief in yourself to get yourself out of bed every day and get your game face on to your staff, which you have to do. You can't turn up grumpy.
And that's great. I was going to talk about the kind of the future as the last part, but just talking about the kind of evolution of Earned Media. I mean, when my first work experience job was at a PR agency, and I, you know, the idea of kind of press was cutting out magazine articles and newspaper articles. I mean, it's come a long, long way since then, with kind of social and more around kind of digital PR and performance. So yeah, how have you kind of seen it kind of unfold, and how different is it from when you started out in the industry?
Great question. It's hugely different. I think PR has changed a lot in the last 5 years. I think there was a seismic shift probably 15, 20 years ago when social media came along. That became a big game changer for many reasons, but mostly really for, I think sort of the definition of PR, you know, if you go and look at it up in an Oxford Collins dictionary, is very, PR still is this outdated definition, which is about basically communicating a corporation's philosophy externally in a very sort of one-dimensional, one-way broadcast fashion. Right, you are transmitting something into the outside world for it to be picked up and written about or digested by your audience. And if you imagine sort of that definition, like how companies ran themselves was, you know, 90% of what goes on at a big corporation or a company, the public would not know about, because all those decisions will happen in the boardroom behind closed doors. And then that board would basically choose to externalize 10% of what they want everyone else to know about. So you won't know 90% of the companies, what happens in companies. When social media came along, it flipped that, right? Because suddenly the game had changed. Social media had to make companies be far more transparent, because before social media, big companies controlled the narrative. They controlled the media message, and there was no real other way of getting the truth out. But then social media happened, and whether if your supply chain was broken or unfair or unscrupulous, or if you were toxic to your employees or your workforce, no one knew about it. But suddenly with social media now, people can tweet stuff. So the truth always came out. Journalists can go and interrogate the facts. They could find people via social media to ask the real questions about companies and where the truth lay. So that became a big game changer. There was this age of spin that happened. You know, this is where the term spin doctors came from, the sort of Alistair Campbell, like Labour sort of approach to communications, which is, these sort of people put on a pedestal because they can control the narrative like he did. Spin was dead, because you couldn't put a spin on it anymore because the truth was there for all to see. And then we sort of came on to the age of transparency, which is sort of where we are a bit now. It's PR has changed astronomically, because there's more PR people now than there are journalists, right? That's mad, right? There are more of people like me trying to tell stories about our clients than there are of the people who are supposed to be receiving those stories. I mean, imagine that as an equation. And I think what that means is, you know, it's really hard to cut through in PR these days. There's loads of redundancies in media. There's loads of cuts being made at national newspaper titles, digital titles, even social media. If you look what's happening on Twitter, which we can come on to in a minute. But that just means that your story is a lot more difficult to communicate. And there's some horrible, scary stats in PR land that, you know, and only 2.5% of your pitches to journalists get answered or read, which is a scary return. And there's another one, which is the Channel 5 news editor comes in every morning and deletes 564 unread emails from his inbox before 9 o'clock. And all of that is communication from brands, right? It's from lazy PRs. You've automated an email to go out that morning with their product's new service or, sorry, their client's new product or service. And it's just been deleted and not read by the person who's being communicated to. So that just means that it is really, you've got to work a lot harder to get your client's story heard about. And it's made us have to be smarter at our game. We've had to sort of become far more content-based, far more creative about the stories we do. And the sort of principles of storytelling have completely changed, right? Because journalists, guess what? There's less of them anyway, but also they are busy writing about news, right? They're writing about the war in Ukraine. They're writing about food banks and the fact that people have to choose between energy and feeding themselves. They're probably, as we speak now, writing about the King's coronation, which is happening this weekend. Not that, that should be news, but they're writing about the things that happen in the world. They don't necessarily want to write about launching this new pen or this new sort of sugar-free water that is so amazing, you have to hear about it. So you really have to work hard with journalists. And we always say to our clients, look, you've got to have these two things in storytelling these days. This is what it does. This is what you need to cut through. You've got to have this enemy or this tension. So you've got to have something that provides a sort of hook for journalists because otherwise it's not a story. So if you think about storytelling all across the years, every great story ever told from the cave ages where they had cave drawings on the walls through to classical texts like the Iliad or the Bible through to you telling your mates a good yarn down the pub on the weekend, all of those stories have good or bad, light or dark, hero and an anti-hero. Because without it, without that sort of enemy or their attention, there is no story. There's nothing. People scroll past on social media because there's nothing to engage you, to draw you in. So you have to have an enemy or attention. And the other thing we say to our clients is, look, you've got to also, as well as have that rub point, you have to align your product with culture. So you've got to ride the coattails of culture. You've got to be aware of what's going on in the world outside and not just be navel-gazing as a brand and think that everyone wants to talk about you, because they don't. No one actually gives a shit about your brand. And that's the truth, because, you know, if you look at us as consumers, we as consumers are deleting all those emails in our inboxes from brands that we signed up to via a purchase transaction that happened 6 months ago. We're buying premium services on Spotify or Netflix to avoid ads. If there is an ad, we're fast-forwarding it on catch-up. So we're avoiding brand communication as consumers. The journalist is deleting our emails, as we've seen. So there's sort of this apathy towards being marketed to. But what we all love and what journalists all love is culture. So if you can attach your sort of brand or your message or your product to culture, and also have an enemy attention, then you can cut through. And that's you've got to be really honest about, you know, how the difficult job it is for PR to do at the moment, because so many people sign up to work with clients and go, yeah, we can do that. Yeah, we'll get you newspapers, and they're flogging a dead horse, and they're spending so much resource internally to try and service that account and that client that they burn their hours and they burn their relationships as a result. So yeah, look, PR is hard, but I don't want to paint too much of a pessimistic view on it. You know, out there there's real opportunity. It's just made us all really, really smarter at our game. And despite the fact that there's less people to take our stories and less journalists in the world, you know, with social media and with how people consume stuff on mobile, and with the technology now around, the potential for a story to travel at light speed across the internet has never been greater, right? And if we can get that formula right with our storytelling and how we execute it and put it out into the outside world, then fame is yours, right? For you, for your clients. And PR has done a good job of growing up over the past 5 to 10 years to really show its value to the boardroom, to show its ROI, and how it can really shift the needle on the business bottom line, but also on brand reputation, which is sort of the two things that people come to any sort of agency to, is like, sell us more of our shit, or change perception of our company.
I guess traditionally you've always had issues with measuring, you know, what that delivers, what PR delivers. And I think, you know, certainly thinking about where brands are becoming more sensitive around measuring return on advertising spend, you know, it's more critical now to be able to demonstrate that. And I guess, you know, the big ideas you come up with can have huge impact and generate huge brand awareness, but ultimately brands want, you know, sales, and they want return on investment. So have you had to change, you know, how you kind of deal with your clients and what your clients want as a result of that kind of shift, I feel?
Yeah, definitely. There's definitely much more commercial scrutiny under the work we do. And I guess that's right. That's also where we are now in the cost of living with squeezed budgets. I mean, I always sort of like to say to clients that, like, you know, how do we know if it's successful? How do we know meeting our KPIs? And I think you will always know, right? I think I always say success is a feeling. I know that sounds really cheesy, but like,
not in the data-driven world that we live in.
But you know, like, you just know, right? You know, because if you're a client, you've seen the buzz that a campaign being executed has generated, even before you've looked at your data on e-com, on the website, even before you've done your tracking and your positive brand sentiment or uplift that you might do quarterly, even before you've looked at your Google Analytics, all that stuff, right? It's a feeling, because you know, because you've seen the coverage, someone you know in the industry will have sent it to you, LinkedIn will be popping off, and that is when you know success. When you haven't had that feeling, that's when it's all a bit edgy. And you're like, oh God, that's when you look to the data, right? You're like, has this actually had any impact at all? But, you know, I guess that's my feeling on it. But obviously some people are numbers people and they need the security of all those metrics we said. So yeah, you do have to have those commercial decisions. We've actually got a big, big entertainment franchise we're working with at the moment, who also have this battle internally as a sort of PR department to prove to give validation to PR efforts to demonstrate that has an actual business benefit. So we're working with them at the moment via some sort of case studies we're putting together to show that an amazing creative idea that happens in the real world or digitally or in the metaverse, wherever it is, can actually translate to commercial success. And to demonstrate that, you have to get your hands on the data. There's no real other way. You can't go into a corporate boardroom and go, it's a feeling, guys, we all feeling good. You do need to have that those sort of numbers at your disposal. So it's important, but you know, you sort of don't want to let that stuff stand in the way of doing stuff either, because PR also is, unlike performance media, which is basically sort of what we're talking about when we talk about metrics, PR is a longer term game, you know, to shift the needle on one consumer's opinion on a brand takes time. And you can't measure it in numbers. You can't measure it across 3 months. You need to constantly have a drumbeat of positive news stories going out about that brand or that service or whatever it is over a period of time, for that consumer to see it, you know, 4 or 5 times before they move to make a purchase transaction as a result. So, and big grown-up clients understand that, they get it. It's only when you like end up talking to, with all due respect to them, like sort of, you know, sort of growth people, people are in charge of real sort of, you know, meteoric growth at scale-ups, that it gets a bit jarring, and trying to explain to them the long-term value of PR, and you've got to be in it you've got to be in it to be in it. Do you know what I mean? So, but yeah, these are all good conversations to have with your client. And it is an odd time out there at the moment. You know, there is squeezed purses for lots of consumers. So internally, anything that isn't affecting the business bottom line in a positive way does get cut. Unfortunately, sometimes PR is part of that.
And we're going to pick up on the kind of wider kind of media and, the industry trends and things. But it feels like, you know, content is now as much about volume as it is about quality. And because there's such a fragmented media landscape and social and influencers, there's a need to produce such a wide variety and volume of content and video and that you're, you know, storytelling that, essentially there has to be some way of, building a huge volume and program of content to keep your brand relevant in a saturated, noisy market. Is that what you advise your clients to do in terms of comm strategy? And is it picking a few key channels, or is it trying to kind of spray and pray?
I mean, look, the one thing I will say is funny. I had this conversation with a very senior national newspaper consumer affairs correspondent recently, right, over contacts versus content, right? What's more important, contacts, i.e. the journalists you know and who you know, that you can pick up the phone to or an email or tweet and say, I've got a story, get it in for me, or content? What's more important? And it was a good debate, actually, and we decided we should look into it a bit more and maybe do some sort of event on it. But I remember when I started out in my PR career, I had a contacts book, right? This is not it, and this is my notebook, but I had a contacts book, which I still have, and it's sort of going to – I'm going to sort of – give it over to the Museum of PR when one exists. But my first boss, basically, it was an address book, A to Z, and you wrote the name of each journalist under their publication, BBC, Daily Telegraph, in pencil. And then as that journalist sort of left or went on, you rubbed it out and you wrote down their replacement. And you wrote down the email address and the phone number, and that was your Bible. Like, that was gold. You carried that everywhere to your meeting. And when my boss used to leaf through hers, it was like, wow, this is like the golden chalice. And my team now, my Gen Zers who work with me, I just laugh at me. Like, I think it was all like, oh yeah, Paul's book, Paul's contact book. And because they're all obsolete now because they've all moved on. But I think it's a good point over what is more important, who you know in the industry and all the content you're putting out. And we're not going to answer that now. That's a bigger thing. But yeah, content is really important. I think that it's definitely not spray and pray. But I think that because of the way that media is now constructed and everything being mostly digital, or web-based or social, the ability to box smart and work efficiently by creating one hero piece of content, which then can work across platform or have different edits or splices to work on different channels, is brilliant. And that's what PR is really good at, because we're not creating outdoor ads that need to sit on digital media sites. That need real spec. We can make something on TikTok that works equally as well on Instagram stories, that can become the basis of something that sits on YouTube and that you can post on Twitter, right? There's a real cost efficiency in doing that. So yes, of course you need to have a proper media plan and specific paid media plan behind each of those channels and understand the algorithms and how they're best deployed. But PR is great at sort of, you know, kind of giving bang for buck to clients on how we can use content effectively. I mean, TikTok's brilliant at that, right? You got literally every editing skit sort of skill you need on your phone now, built into an app. You know, you don't have to go and download, you know, the sort of all the stuff you need on a laptop anymore to make good content. It's all done in app on phone, and you can just save it off and send it wherever. So we live in this kind of real boon of technology that's really played into our hands as far as how we create and disseminate content. And that's why, I guess, social media agencies have had a fantastic few years. It's also why influencer agencies are very successful currently, particularly in the M&A market, as you know, because influencers are the creators, and they are, you know, if you pick the right ones, they do the work for you, and they post it on their channels. So they have the captive audience too. So it's sort of a brilliant setup, really.
And yeah, that sort of brings on to the kind of wider media and industry trends. And yeah, interested to hear your kind of view on the emerging areas. I mean, TikTok's been big for several years and is kind of eating up kind of Instagram and Snap, but also Twitter's reemergence with Elon Musk. How much of those, what are your views of the direction of those platforms as tools for building kind of better earned media strategies? What are the kind of things for, I guess, brands to watch out for at the same time?
Yeah, fascinating year in social media at the moment with everything going on. I think starting with Twitter, I think Twitter is basically probably going to go down as the big, great media car crash of 2022, right? Elon Musk purchasing that platform was just insane and continues to be insane. And, you know, he sort of came in there and made loads of cuts and sort of like, you know, a bit like a asset management, you know, came in and stripped the company down to its core bones. So he got rid of all the sort of perceived fat. And that's been bad news. It's been bad news for brands. It's been bad news for news. It's been bad news for transparency. And it's been bad news for PR. And the reasons for that are, you know, what all those people he got rid of were the people who curated. They were the editorial people. They weren't the people who made Twitter, you know, stay live or continue to work. They were the people who created the stories and worked with news organizations to promote positive content and interesting content and truthful content. And he's got rid of all those people, which means that it's so much harder for news to travel because those people just don't exist anymore. So that was really bad. And, you know, all this sort of money changing hands between big news organizations and Twitter as far as licensing deals. I think Twitter was losing sort of about 4 million quid a day by paying those news organizations for their story. So he just got rid of all those relationships as a cost saving exercise. The other thing he did was obviously started charging for the blue tick, which is something that's still rolling on now as to whether people should acquire it or not. But that's where a mass exodus of people from the platform. It's like, you're going to take away my blue tick. How dare you? I'm out of here. And when you have people leaving the platform like that, or the removal of those blue ticks and people being unwilling to pay back for them because they've never paid for them before, why am I going to pay for them now? That's really dangerous insofar as spoof accounts setting up. So, you know, people suddenly taking the moniker of a famous journalist or a famous personality and pretending to be that person or purporting to be that person. That just means that disinformation can slow easily because, you know, you don't know who's who. You can tweet something and it could be a fake account and that could travel at light speed across social media and just gets retweeted, and no one checks facts anymore. So they go and see if the source is real or not. So Twitter's basically a mess at the moment. There was an interesting stat that I think the brand spend on it from a marketing point of view was down a ridiculous percentage. I can't remember what it is now, but brands are definitely exercising caution in how they interact with Twitter right now. And I think that's right, because the dust needs to settle. after his purchase era, because you know we need to figure out how the algorithm is still working for us, if it is. So I think Twitter's interesting and doesn't seem to have its fate decided yet, but it could be its renaissance this year, and it could be its demise.
How about Jack Dorsey's new platform, Blue Sky? Do you know much about that? Jack Dorsey's new social platform, Blue Sky.
Yeah, you know Blue Sky. And also, the Instagram fellas have brought out something new as well, haven't they? Lime, I think it is, or something. I mean, I don't know. I mean, look what's happened to Clubhouse, right? I think there will continue to be many startups in social media. But I think at the moment, TikTok is where most people are residing. I think TikTok's got everyone from Twitter to Instagram, you know, sort of chasing their tails a bit, which I think is really interesting to see, because if you look at what's happened to TikTok and the journey it's been on, it's had a bumpy few years, particularly firstly around that regulation and privacy with kids. Came into a lot of stick globally for exposing kids to content they shouldn't be seeing, and the loopholes around that. They seem to have sorted that out with some really good sort of corporate responsibility and sort of crisis comms. But now, obviously, they are being called the sort of, you know, the spyware of the Chinese state, and government officials globally are sort of been asked to delete it from their phone. So I think whether that sort of becomes carpet-wide bans in different global markets is yet to be seen. But they're certainly having this moment in the light so far as consumers care. You know, if you look at where people reside at the moment, their user base astronomically shot up during COVID and lockdown, with, you know, billions of downloads. And actually they've really grown in importance in how people are receiving their news in the UK. So I think between 2020 and 2022, they grew as a news source in the UK from 0.8% to 0.8 million to 3.9 million. It's a 6% growth in 2 years. So UK adults getting their news actually from TikTok versus any other source. That's huge, right? And it's sort of scary, but is actually very indicative of where we are in earned media at the moment, because people are now consuming bite-sized news on the go more than they ever have. No one gets the Metro anymore because no one commutes anymore. No one gets the Evening Standard anymore because no one commutes anymore and they're paper thin. No one buys traditional newspapers anymore because they can get the news elsewhere, and no one even watches the 6 o'clock news anymore because life's too busy. So most people are consuming news and media on these things, right? And that's just fascinating, and has really played into the hands. And like broadcasters and traditional news sites have luckily got wise to the power of TikTok, so they're sort of splicing up their stories into a bite-sized format and putting them onto TikTok, because they know if the content's good, and generally it is from like ITV News or The Times or something, they know how to storytell. If they can play the algorithm, then their stories just get shared disproportionately across TikTok, and that's good. That's good that those sort of the bastions of legacy media have understood how to operate on TikTok, and that's good. But it's not just news that TikTok are doing well. The reason they're also having that moment in the sun is because of new features they're implementing. So they're testing in Asia at the moment this near me feature, which has got Google slightly worried, because it's basically now become the sort of destination for Gen Z for search. So rather than going to Google and saying, you know, find a pub near me or a restaurant near me or shopping near me, they're going into TikTok because they'll get served up a video of it looking amazing, and they can decide if they want to go there or not. And they're trialing that near me function. So if you go in and search, you'll only get served up videos from your immediate vicinity, which basically is like the Google near me feature. So search has become really big for them, and they're sort of throwing a lot of investment behind making that work. And the other thing that they're doing, which is part of a wider trend in social media anyway, is e-com. And I think, you know, you and I, whenever we scroll on our chosen social media channels, I've certainly noticed that it's far more commercial. You know, they're sort of, I'm getting fed loads more sponsored content. I'm seeing loads more influencers doing stuff with brands where it's like a live shopping channel. You can buy this or that, you know, swipe up now, all that stuff. And I think in the TikTok shop retreated from the UK in last year, actually, 2022, they pulled out of the UK because they hadn't got the formula right. No one was using it. But the same sort of feature on the Chinese version of the app sells 10 billion products a year. And that's a huge, huge opportunity to use a social media platform to actually for e-commerce. So they're currently, despite the fact they pulled out the UK, they're currently obviously getting the formula right to enter back into the UK. And when they do, I think there's a lot of money to be made for brands on TikTok, working with influencers, creating content, doing live shopping channels, just in the way that QVC used to or still does. So I think, yeah, TikTok's going nowhere unless the US government decides it's going somewhere.
Well, yeah, that's a big risk. They could just switch it off. Question on kind of industry trends, which we're kind of following, which is around kind of Web3 applications, things like social channels like Discord, that where you can create your own kind of closed communities and build your own communities outside the traditional big tech platforms. Do you advise clients, or what's your kind of view on those as a communications channel and focus for brands?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of depends what brand you are. The it's always about the barrier to entry, isn't it? And that's the barrier to entry is twofold. There's a consumer barrier to entry. How do I access Web3? Apple make some inroads to that this summer when they bring out their headset. Oculus Rift is great, but a bit clumsy. You're sort of stumbling around trying to have this Web3 experience. And Apple have promised to bring out their slick offering to this piece of hardware this year. And the price tag on it is looking like it's going to be about £2,000 to £3,000. As I understand, which some people will pay, but others won't. But listen, it'll be Apple, so it'll be slick. It'll be connected to your phone. It will have a decent battery life. The UX will be amazing. So I think the barrier to entry will drop when Apple come into it, insofar as consumers having a piece of hardware which is connected to what's in their pocket, their iPhone, that can easily allow them a Web3 seamless experience. The other barrier to entry for Web3 is cost, right? If you're a brand and you want to get into the Web3, it's not cheap. You know, you have to have a good experience. And making Web3 content takes investment. But if you're in that space and, you know, you're a fashion brand or you're a gaming brand, yes, you can see they're experimenting it. They've got the deep pockets in order to be able to do so. There's been some interesting opportunities or pieces of content made in Web3 already, you know, whether you're flying off the top of the Matterhorn as Red Bull have done, which is pretty cool. The Guardian did a Web3 experience where you could feel what it was like to sit in a solitary confinement cell for 23 hours a day. So they shot this piece of content with a headset and being
I think I'll give that a miss.
Yeah, give that a miss, mate. Yeah, we'll put the link in the show notes, and watch it. And then I think Aardman and the BBC teamed up to do what it's like for a refugee to travel from their war-torn country across the Channel into the UK borders as a headset experience. So that's also one you to check out or miss. But that's all interesting, right? Because it puts the consumer right in the story. And so once they crack what Web3 is like for you know, kind of to be on the F1 grid at the start of a race, or, you know, if you're that way minded, to be there on election night as Labour in the next election. Sorry, it's not political. And those are interesting experiences that Web3 can deliver. But I think it's hard at the moment because the barriers to entry are great. So I guess what we say to our kind of clients are, yes, if you're in that space, test and learn, get some skin in the game, understand it, make some investment in it. But I think there's a way to go yet for consumers en masse to adopt Web3 as a channel or as a place to interact with brands or as a sort of place to hang out, because there's just too many cost barriers and technology barriers currently. Interesting space though.
Yeah. Thank you. No, it's interesting. I mean, clearly there's, you know, it's about volume of content and about speed of turning things around and using technology and being ahead of all these kind of new social platforms. But yeah, things like extended reality are going to be exciting for brands, and the kind of advance of search, as you said, through TikTok and through AI and ChatGPT and Bard. So but yeah, one final section really around the future for agencies. What's going through your mind around what agencies should be doing now, next, and in the future to future-proof their business, starting with now? I guess AI is probably the biggest topic at the moment, which everyone's bored of hearing about, probably talking about. But is this something you're able to build into your offering quite quickly, or are you going to sort of watch and see how it evolves?
I think both, right? Because it's funny, I think as agencies, you always want to be the agency that is suggesting the cool new things to your client first from their agency set. Because if you're not doing it, the design agency will do it, the sort of ad agency will do it, the social agency will do it, the web agency will do it, whoever it is. So you always want to be the one that presents to the client that shiny new thing, even if you don't get it yourself, right? You know, you can upskill and school yourself very quickly on these new emerging technologies and you know, create a presentation for your clients or a sharing forum where they can sort of understand the implications that will have on their business. I think that's really important to do. Right, it, for us as content professionals to grasp the sort of evolving technologies in our industry so we can advise our clients, you know, how to respond to them. So I think, yes, we're doing all that, right? And there's so much chat, excuse the pun, about ChatGPT at the moment. And I think for an art in the sort of creative industry, I think you've got to leverage it for good. You've got to play around with it so you understand how it works, or else you're not even in the conversation. And I think you've got to use it in a way that capitalizes on efficiency. So yes, we're scared that AI is going to take our jobs. Yes, we're scared of the fact that we might have robot overlords in the near or very near future. But right now, the stuff it can do for you is amazing. It takes the grunt work out of writing documents, of updating your website, of creating T's and C's, of contracts. And none of that should be done in a silo and sent without human intervention and sign-off. But its ability to help produce content is amazing. So we as professionals are using it and will continue to use it. So I think yeah, future proofing ourselves is for technology is the right thing to do this year. I think one of the things we are doing really well, and I think other businesses are also doing, is just reassuring their staff, because we have the great resignation or quiet quitting and all these things, and cost of living worries everyone. It's really important to stop churn, because churn is expensive and inefficient. Clients get pissed off and you know, when staff leave, and so keeping staff happy across this year is really important. And the reason we should do that is because as I believe next year will be hopefully some sort of return to normal, and you need your good people in place next year to come out of the traps quickly and effectively so that you can continue to grow as an agency, which sort of is like going on to the next bit, right? You've got to be positioning yourself now in the right way to capitalize on market stability in 2024. And that includes just, yeah, like I say, retaining your staff, ensuring that you're making the right amount of noise now as an agency, so people are seeing you and have you in their thoughts when they're making, sort of purchasing decisions as far as their agency set or their rosters. And that's really important because the growth is quite sort of not flat lines, but sort of slow at the moment, I think, in our industry, certainly, because not those big pitches currently aren't happening because of the new financial year, and a lot of clients are sort of being a bit sort of safe in how they make those big purchasing decisions when they go out shopping for new agencies. But that's going to change in H2. In 2024. So I think making the right amount of noise now and being relevant to your future clients is really important things we should be focusing on over the next sort of 6 to 18 months. And then looking ahead into your crystal ball, Mark, for 2 to 5 years, as we cannot do. I think understanding what's coming down the pipeline as far as market shifts in emerging technology that can affect the communication landscape is super important.
I just want to pick up a point about, you know, keeping staff happy. It's kind of easier said than done. But yeah, what kind of things are you doing to I guess excite, retain, grow your staff so they stick around, or you know, don't feel kind of stressed about the industry and the outlook?
Yeah, I mean, I think so many things, right? But treating them with respect is the first and foremost thing. Forget all perks, strip away all of that, right? Before you even get into, you know, team away days and, you know, free gym memberships and all those things that are sort of perks for well-being. It's just paying your staff well, having the respect for their work-life balance. Understanding their pressures and their cost of living, the pressure they're under to pay rent, to pay their bills, to pay their energy bills, stuff like that. As an employer, you can really help out in small doses, and that goes a long way.
Can you come into the office 5 days? What's your view on remote working versus being in the office?
I think the hybrid model works for a lot of people. I think it's the best of both worlds. I think it sort of allows people to be efficient. We're in a sort of 3 day work from the office, 2 day at home. I think that's valued, and that could change, but I think we'll always maintain 1 day at home because I think it's good to sort of dot the I and cross the T's when you're not in the office environment to get stuff done. But the other thing I was going to say, so far as just looking after your staff, is just dialogue. You've got to be, as a leader, as an agency owner, as CEO, you really got to over communicate because so much stuff happens in your head that people don't know about, and you need to bring them on the journey with you and communicate the good and communicate the bad as it happens in order to get people's trust and to have them bought into the business and your direction of travel. So I think those are just like two really simple hygiene factors that sometimes we can forget because we're trying to create the most amazing cultural environment that an agency can ever have. And we've got dogs that you stroke, and we have team away days that are like, you know, going paintballing or yoga trips or whatever, but staff just really want the basics. Of course,
Do you think more people want to be freelance? Is there something around the structure of an agency in the future that won't necessarily be kind of full permanent heads, and it's going to be, you know, you're thinking about what different skill sets you're going to need that
you know, might be relevant to kind of emerging technologies versus, you know, the traditional agency structure and team setup that there was before.
Yeah, I mean, that is interesting, particularly with AI and how that develops, whether there is the need for all these bodies of people doing stuff. You know, a networked agency that employs freelancers when the work comes in, because a lot of the, let's just say, reporting or document writing can be automated now. That is interesting. And I think clients also will sort of look to decrease spend with agencies, because a lot of the line items that we used to have in place, like particularly in PIs, you know, if you've got a journalist who's interviewed one of your clients, for all the documentation that's needed around that, so far as a press release needs writing, a briefing book needs to be written, Q&As, all that sort of grant work that takes ages to do on a computer can now be done a lot more efficiently. So I think clients will be saying, well, where's my cost saving in this? All that can be, I can do that in-house so much quicker, just with the click of a button. So I think, yeah, clients will have our budgets under scrutiny, and that obviously affects, you know, how much resource we have from a budget perspective to employ teams. So I think it'll be an interesting one. I haven't got the answer for you, but I think change is always good, right? Because it makes us respond and provide solutions to problems in a way that makes our businesses better and streamlined and gives clients
better. Thank you. We've hit the hour, so thank you very much for your time, Paul, and your insights. Really interesting to hear about kind of views of the market. And hopefully, the second half of the year will be kind of a change in kind of feeling for clients and brands and agencies. I hope your prediction is true.
Yes, come on, H2.
So thanks for your time, Paul. And please like and subscribe to the channel. See you on the next one.
Cheers, Mark.
Take care.